The middle class and the army came to fear the SA. To the army, the SS was a more acceptable organization, like themselves. The members of the SS were from the German upper class.
The SS consisted very often of professional people, doctors, solicitors, and so on. They joined the SS while ordinary working people were in the SA. And they didn't like each other.
The military offered the Führer a deal. Their full support if Hitler would eliminate the SA. Hitler accepted, and with Himmler, rid the party of the stormtroopers in one night.
The night of the long knives, that happened on the 30th of June 1934, so I was then just 12 years old. I remember it. The SA had a congress in Wiessee, not far from Munich. And they were all in bed at night when Hitler and the SS moved.
The SA leadership was rounded up and executed so quickly, so ruthlessly, many never knew why. It's reported some were still shouting, "Heil Hitler," when they died. After the purge of the SA, Himmler transformed the SS into an elite military order. In time, they would come to run the concentration camps where Jews and all other enemies of the state were being executed. But Himmler's vision of the SS was not yet complete. He planned to turn the SS into Germany's new aristocracy, the new Superman, prophesied by Hitler's religion of the blood.
Himmler's conception of the SS was no less than the creation of a new bloodstock elite for the Nazi order in Europe. At every stage, the SS was constantly reminded that it was no less than a warrior elite whose values of hardness and military valor were absolutely central to its existence. And more than that, that they were in fact ensuring the survival of the race in this way.
Himmler was born a Catholic, but by the time he met Hitler, he was already a confirmed occultist.
It's difficult for us afterwards to equate this man, who certainly believed in a god, and to link him up with a man who was master of the killing machine in Germany. But actually the two things, of course, are linked, because what he was trying to do was to root out the forces which he believed had corrupted Germany and get back to their pure-blooded forefathers.
Himmler brought a range of unlikely influences to his design for the SS, including the Hindu religion. During the war, he reportedly traveled with a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, a holy book from the Hindu religion. It tells the story of a great battle on the field of righteousness between the forces of good and evil. The Hindu belief in reincarnation and its rigid caste system appealed to Himmler. It was a perfect model for a Nazi warrior elite which would rule the world. Historians now say that Himmler was convinced that he was the reincarnation of King Heinrich, a German leader from the Middle Ages who stopped the Slavs from invading Germany. As the Nazis prepared to march on Eastern Europe, Himmler believed he was on the path to realizing his karmic destiny, that his SS had returned to the fatherland to fight a similar holy war. On the night of July the 1st, 1937, to mark the millennium anniversary of King Heinrich's death, Himmler staged a sacred reburial rite at Quedlinburg Cathedral, the original location of the great king's castle and the site of his tomb. Accompanied by solemn music, Himmler and a group of high-ranking SS officers led a torch-bearing procession to the candlelit crypt. There, he led them in prayer and meditation. The king's remains were placed in a new grave, and Himmler laid a wreath of oak leaves, a symbol of ancient pagan origin. He eulogized the man he believed he had been in a past life. As the sarcophagus was sealed, he pledged to fulfill the king's mission of conquering the lands to Germany's east. Himmler modeled his SS on the 13th century order of Teutonic Knights, who killed and enslaved the people they conquered. The parallels with Nazi Germany's own practices were unmistakable. The Reichsfuhrer SS attempted to reinstate the feudal system that the Knights had lived by. As new lands were conquered, each SS officer was to take possession of a feudal estate. Local people were either killed or turned into slave labor. Like the Teutonic Knights, Himmler transformed a series of ancient castles into SS training schools that were both military and religious centers. Here, recruits were initiated into the ways of so-called warrior priests. In 1934, Himmler chose Wevelsburg as his personal castle. It became a sacred center for the inner core of his elite SS knights.
Himmler chose Wevelsburg because he was told by his occult or spiritual advisor that this was going to be the magical strong point of German resistance to a great army from the east. And there would be a great battle there, and the eastern hordes would be turned back.
Himmler had grandiose plans for his medieval castle at Wevelsburg. But this required a prodigious workforce. To assure an ample supply of slave labor, he built a concentration camp nearby. From 1939 to 1945, 4,000 prisoners worked on Himmler's castle. Nearly a third of them died while working on it.
When one looks at the plans and memoranda, and indeed the miniature models that were laid out of how the Wevelsburg would ultimately rebuild, it indeed looks like the Holy City in Rome.
Wevelsburg is built in the shape of a triangle with three corner towers. Around this basic design, Himmler had plans to build a large colony.
The village would have been demolished and cleared, and they would have created a huge site with interlocking spaces, barricades, other turrets, and circular curtain walls sweeping over a vast area, creating no less than a kind of SS Vatican.
It was the Great Northern Tower that would become the focus of Himmler's plans to make Wevelsburg an SS occult center. At the base of the tower, Himmler built a crypt. According to historians, it was a temple to honor the dead SS leaders. The vaulted ceiling created an eerie acoustic. And in the middle of the well would have burned a kind of holy fire. Along the edges of the crypt were 12 pedestals, upon which would have stood urns, waiting to contain the ashes of deceased generals.
What would happen is the SS always had to have the 13 leadership. And consequently, when an SS general died, he was ritually cremated, his ashes were placed, and then his place was taken by a new general.
In one legend, King Arthur gathered the 12 most chivalrous knights in a great hall. In Himmler's version, he created the Hall of SS Supreme Leaders in a room above the crypt. Here he would meet with his 12 highest-ranking SS officers. A large sun wheel adorned the floor. This radial pattern was made up of symbols from the ancient Nordic alphabet. Himmler tried to create a replica of the Grail Chapel from the Arthurian legend. A mystical chalice, the Grail was said to have contained sacred blood.
Himmler saw the Grail as an object of immense esoteric or occult power, and he believed that if he possessed this physical object, that the war would be won with great ease.
To Himmler, the sacred blood of the Grail legend was pure Aryan blood. He believed it possessed a magical quality. His closest advisor on Grail lore was archaeologist Otto Rahn. Also obsessed with the Grail legend, Rahn believed it was hidden in the caves of southern France. Himmler was drawn to Rahn's knowledge of the occult and his lifelong pursuit of the Grail. Once in Himmler's inner circle at Wevelsburg, Rahn would continue his quest for the Holy Grail, only now as a knight of the Nazi Party. Himmler personally funded Rahn's expeditions, several of which concentrated on the area around Montségur in southern France. There stood the site of the great fortress of the Cathars, the heretical sect accused of devil worship and wiped out by the church in the 13th century.
And there was a very strong tradition, as indeed there still is, that the Cathars had possessed the secret of the Grail, and that just before the castle of Montségur fell, the three knights of the Cathar order escaped over the walls and took something with them, something of great value. Tradition later said that this was the Grail, or that it was the secret of the Grail, and that they hid it in the whole warren of caves.
Rahn's expeditions also took place in Germany. A letter on file from Rahn to SS headquarters suggests that he believed he was close to realizing his lifelong dream. To bring my work to a successful conclusion, I must personally inspect the sites. First, I have to go to the Wildenberg ruins, the German castle of the Holy Grail. There are currently digs underway. Heil Hitler. But Rahn was never able to secure the ultimate prize, the sacred chalice itself. In 1939, Otto Rahn mysteriously resigned from the SS. Many believed Himmler issued orders to have Rahn killed once it was clear his quest for the Grail had failed. Two months later, he was found dead in the Austrian Alps. The cause of his death remains unexplained. In his continued quest to prove the superiority of the Aryan race, Himmler created a research institute called the Ancestral Heritage Organization. In addition to conducting medical experiments on human beings and checking bloodlines to ensure racial purity, the organization's mission was to resurrect and reinterpret occult practices, ancient Germanic myths, and pagan lore. This Nazi film shows one such ritual, young girls dancing around the Nordic pagan symbol of war and divine order. To control all occult knowledge, Himmler confiscated the libraries and artifacts of any occult society that was not associated with him. This included secret societies such as the Freemasons, who the Nazis believed were an occult organization created by the Jews to conspire against the Germanic people. While Himmler suppressed certain occultists, he also advanced the careers of others, such as Karl Maria Willigut. In Willigut, Himmler believed he'd found the key to popularizing the ancient pagan tradition in modern Germany. The mystic became a high-ranking SS officer and one of Himmler's prized possessions.
Well, the interesting thing about Willigut is that he is really perhaps the leading example of an occultist in the immediate circle and service of Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler.
Willigut believed he was a direct descendant of the Norse god Thor. Copies of his papers found in Himmler's personal file reveal that Willigut believed he possessed extrasensory powers. One document entitled The Nine Commandments of God was signed by Willigut and initialed by Himmler. Written in both modern German and the runic alphabet, it suggests that Willigut thought he was using his powers to rediscover the ancient rites and rituals of Germany's pagan past. According to Nordic legend, the runic alphabet used by Willigut was given to mankind by Odin, the supreme god in Norse mythology. This sacred alphabet was his gift to mankind.
The runes were derived from probably from a mixture of ancient signs that are carved on stone in pre-literate times. And these alphabets actually had meanings. Each letter has a meaning.
The Hagal rune, protection of the bearer against his enemies. The Odal rune, one's connection to the clan or tribe. The Tyr rune, victory and world order. The Sig rune, the sun or conquering energy. These symbols appeared throughout the Nordic world on such objects as Viking ships, battle spears and shields. The alphabet of ancient priests and magicians, runes were believed to be mystical tools for fortune telling, casting spells and invoking magical spirits.
You cast the runes, somewhat analogous to a tarot layout. You throw them and then you read the particular combinations of runes that arise. It has got the reputation of being an extraordinarily powerful magical system.
As Germany's warrior elite, members of the SS were taught the meaning of the runes. A photograph that survived the war shows an SS officer at a blackboard teaching the runes to a class of SS recruits.
Many organizations within the Third Reich had their own special rune. The SS, perhaps the best known, of course, used the double Sig rune.
These mysterious figures were worn on the shoulders and helmets of all SS uniforms. The Hitler Youth used a single SIG room. These ancient mystical symbols were seemingly everywhere. Serving as a constant reminder to Germans of their pagan past.
After the SS recruit had passed his training and taken the oath, if he was an officer, he was then given the SS dagger, which was a sort of hunting knife with a black handle, the SS runes on it, the swastika and a wreath, and the German eagle. And this was a very prized possession.
Engraved into the dagger were the words, "My honor is called trust." SS men received the dagger in a solemn ceremony. Every member of the SS wore the SS signet ring. But for his inner circle, the elite of the elite, Himmler personally handed out the Death's Head ring. A former high-ranking SS officer, Wilhelm Hertel, still remembers the ceremonious occasion.
The ring was engraved with your name, mine, for example, to my dear Hertel, Heinrich Himmler. That was inside the ring, around a death head. That was supposed to symbolize the close connection to the SS and to Himmler.
In a speech given to SS officers stationed at Dachau, Himmler stated, "Never forget, we are a knightly order from which one cannot withdraw, to which one is recruited by blood, and within which one remains body and soul." Borrowing from Germany's pagan past and his own Catholic upbringing, Himmler invaded SS family rituals from the moment of birth.
One picture we have, which shows a full tableau of such a sort of Nazi or Hitler shrine for the purpose of baptism of infants, an SS altar in place of a crucifix, a picture of Hitler, and the babe would have been presented, if you like, into the community of Germanic warriors through this kind of tableau.
The marriage ceremony also became an SS ritual. Mimicking ancient Germanic tribes, SS officers took on the role of the clan leader who presided over marriages. Himmler himself officiated at one such ceremony. This rare footage shows one of his SS officers marrying Gretel, the sister of Hitler's mistress, Eva Braun. Rings were exchanged, as well as bread and salt, the ancient pagan symbols for the fertility and purity of the soil.
These ritual activities would take place to imply the pagan community of which every SS man and his bride was now a part.
The Nazi year was marked with celebrations taken from the ancient Germanic calendar. The Maypole Festival, initially accepted as a celebration of fertility, was transformed into a show of nationalism and military strength. Hitler said, "And so it is that this day, the 1st of May, the land is filled with celebrations of the resurrection of the German people out of eternal inner strife."
People need festivals to mark the year. And they tried to substitute the pagan festivals for the Christian festivals. They began to annex the festivals which the pagans had celebrated. Summer solstice, winter solstice, all these festivals, yes? And shaped them in their own image.
Nazis even began to restore ancient pagan temples like Externstein, which was dedicated to a solar deity. At Externstein, During the summer solstice, a shaft of light shines through a window and lines up with a point on the altar. While Echternstein was considered a holy place for Germanic tribes, it is far from unique among ancient temples in tracking the sun's movements. Himmler was convinced, however, that it was proof of the superior intellect of prehistoric Germanic priests. In Nazi Germany, the festival at the summer solstice would be turned into a fascist rite. Traditionally, summer solstice festivals were a celebration of life and of the sun's powers. Dramatically staged and carefully choreographed, speeches were given preaching self-sacrifice and heroism. In this particular ritual, Propaganda Minister Goebbels gave the speech. In ancient times, the bonfire represented the ritual relighting of the sun. In Nazi Germany, they were tributes to the Führer. In the largest of these rituals, torch-bearing troops created symbolic patterns in the night. At the end of the year, the long night of the winter solstice honored Germany's dead. Himmler explains in his Dachau speech. The winter solstice is not just the end of the year, but it is also the festival on which one thought of the ancestors and of the past, on which the individual is clear that he is nothing, an atom to be wiped away at any time, while linked in the eternal chain of his lineage by a true humility. The full calendar of rituals culminated with the rally at Nuremberg, where the vows between party and people were renewed year after year. Tens of thousands of uniformed Nazis joined forces. The week-long rally was orchestrated to sweep people up in a spectacle of sheer power.
Now, every religion has its ritual. The Nazis had their ritual, their mass rituals, yes? What did it give to people, these mass meetings? When the merchant leaves his lonely shop, yeah, and joins in the crowd in action, then he feels one, and he's happy. One with the others, and he's happy. He's lost his loneliness.
Oh, it was great to go to a rally. All the uniforms, and there was an electric atmosphere already before it all started. There was singing going on, and then suddenly it was announced, Der Führer kommt, the Führer is coming. And then we saw him walking up to the stage, and there was shouting of Heil, 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 Heil.
As the Nazi frenzy swept Germany, Hitler made clear what he expected from the nation. The party is the selecting ground for German political leaders. Its doctrine will be unchangeable. Its organizations will be as hard as steel. Its total image, however, will be like a holy order. The Nazi mass rallies were carefully orchestrated to build to an overwhelming emotional epiphany. It evoked a religious fervor. At the center of this ritual was Hitler. Everything was constructed to make Hitler look like divinity. A messiah. Having won the unquestioning support of the German people, Hitler was now ready to dominate the world. From the onset of the war in 1939, country after country fell to the Nazis. By the winter of 1942, however, the tide turned, and the Nazis began to experience what they thought was impossible. Defeat. As the Nazi war effort grew more and more desperate, they expanded their use of the occult sciences, from research and ritual to a basis for making military decisions. Certain members of the German Naval Command became convinced that the Allies were already employing mystical forces to wage war against Germany. They believed that the British successes at locating and destroying German U-boats had been achieved through occult means, and that the best way to combat this was also by using the occult as a weapon. This led Himmler to establish a top-secret institute dedicated to the ancient occult practice of pendulum dowsing. Over maps of the North Atlantic, clairvoyants would swing an object suspended from a string, attempting to locate the position of Allied convoys. German U-boat missions were dispatched based on the results. In this letter written by Himmler, dated January the 12th, 1943, he refers to dowsing research and training having made great progress during the year. Still, the most common occult arts employed by the Nazis were astrology and prophecy, although they were approached in two distinctly different ways. Rudolf Hess and Heinrich Himmler genuinely believed in the occult and used it for making political decisions. But Joseph Goebbels, head of the propaganda ministry, wanted to use the occult purely for propaganda purposes, to manipulate people and undermine Allied morale. Goebbels soon became aware of a great source of mystical knowledge, the predictions of Nostradamus. One of the most celebrated visionaries of all time, Nostradamus completed his masterpiece of prophecy in 1555. The book contains subtle references to a crisis in Britain and Poland in the year 1939, the year Nazi Germany invaded Poland. Nearly 400 years after Nostradamus wrote his book. For Goebbels, Nostradamus was a perfect propaganda tool, whose work could be interpreted as predicting a great victory in Germany's future.
Nostradamus' prophecies are written in four-line poems called quatrains, and they're so dense and esoteric that you can interpret them in many different ways.
To interpret the French prophet, Goebbels recruited renowned astrologer and Nostradamus expert Karl Ernst Kraft. A particular quatrain that Goebbels seized on seemed to refer directly to Hitler and quickly became part of the Nazi leader's mystique.
There's a very famous quatrain which has got the word hyster in it, which, you know, was everyone was bandying around, was saying that that was Hitler.
In Goebbels' diary, he expressed his excitement when Bernd, a member of his staff, began to formulate a plan to use the prophecy. 19th of May, 1942. Bernd handed in a plan for the occultist propaganda to be carried on by us. We are getting somewhere. The Americans and English fall easily to this kind of propaganda. We are therefore pressing into service all star witnesses of occult prophecy. Nostradamus must once again submit to being quoted. The creation of fake prophecies and fraudulent mysticism to influence the enemy became known as black propaganda.
Yes, they made up a flyer of the Nostradamus prophecies and threw them all over France, that France would be destroyed if it did not capitulate.
British intelligence discovered the deception and, recognizing its propaganda potential, began to wage their own Nostradamus campaign.
The British actually picked up on this. They produced a volume of 50 fake Nostradamus prophecies which forecast British victory on the war.
Just as the Nazis had flooded France with fake Nostradamus prophecies, the Allies smuggled their own black propaganda into Germany. The black propaganda campaign in England soon took a new turn with the arrival of Hungarian Jewish emigre and astrologer Louis de Vol. Recruited by British intelligence, de Vol was assigned to work with master counterfeiter Elik Hall.
And Elik's great skill was as a forger. I mean, you know, forging documents, forging magazines, forging Nostradamus quatrains.
Hall and de Vol decided to create a counterfeit version of Germany's leading astrological magazine, Zenit.
They produced two issues in 1943. In these, they would try and make forecasts which would undermine German morale. They would, for example, say, watch out for June the 30th, the anniversary of the Night of the Long Knives. Now, the purpose behind this forecast was to somehow plant in the minds of the Germans the fact that the SS might now be disloyal to Hitler.
But Howe's masterstroke came with a so-called special edition of Der Zenit, dated April 1943. He cleverly waited until July to publish an April edition, thus seemingly being able to predict events he knew would come true.
And what Howe and his colleagues did was to look at the sinking of German submarines, record the dates, and then, in producing the April edition, produced these dates as if they were forecasts.
British intelligence believed that if these predictions were picked up by the crews of German U-boats, the result would be a loss of morale and possibly even mutiny. The British counterfeiter Der Zenit, however, contained one glaring error. They incorrectly titled the magazine Der Zenit, instead of the actual title, Zenit. astrology and espionage would soon collide again, in what is still considered by many to be the most bizarre incident of the Second World War. When Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer and one of Hitler's closest friends and advisors, made an astonishing solo flight to Scotland. Hess's idea to make the flight began with his belief that the British, a Nordic race, would be made sympathetic to the Aryan cause and could even be persuaded to side with the Germans if only Churchill could be overthrown. One of Hess's mentors, Karl Haushofer, reinforced this idea by telling Hess about a dream he had. In it, he saw Hess walking through a Scottish castle with tapestries hanging from the walls, bringing peace between Germany and Great Britain. In addition to prophecy, astrology would also come to play a role in Hess's decision to make the flight.
Rudolf Hess, along with Himmler, was probably the leading Nazi most interested in astrology. He accepted it totally.
Astrologer and close friend Ernst Schulte Strathaus cast a horoscope for the deputy Führer that revealed an auspicious arrangement of the planets.
On May 10th, 1941, there was a particularly powerful astronomical lineup. Basically, there were six planets in Taurus and a full moon exactly on the opposite side of the zodiac in Scorpio. And according to astrological tradition, when you get such a lineup, you'll get a major shift in global affairs. And therefore, it was fair to assume that May the 10th, 1941 could provide the turning point in the war.
There has always been some doubt whether Hess flew to Scotland based upon astrological advice. However, recently discovered documents written by Hess from prison in England include a letter to his mother. In it, he asked her to have two documents notarized: a record of Karl Haushofer's dream and the horoscope cast by Schulte Strathaus. Before Hess made the flight, some believe he conferred with the Führer.
6 days before my father flew, there was a discussion between Hitler and my father, which lasted 4 hours. Nobody knows what they were talking, but one knows that when the 4 hours were over, my father and Hitler came from the room, and Hitler had his arm around the shoulder of my father and said, "Hess, you have been always and are still a very stubborn chap. This is a very friendly goodbye."
Whatever words passed between Hitler and Hess at 5:45 p.m. on May the 10th, 1941, Hess climbed into a Messerschmitt fighter and set off for Scotland. His plan was to meet with the Duke of Hamilton, a man he'd met through Karl Haushofer. Hess hoped to use the Duke to bypass Churchill and attempt to make peace directly with the King of England. Having written the Duke several letters in advance of his mission, Hess was expecting a warm welcome.
But the letters that he sent my father were, of course, all intercepted by the Secret Service.
Instead of a greeting party, when Hess entered British airspace, he was shot down by the RAF and forced to bail out.
He hurt himself getting out of the aircraft, certainly hurt himself on landing. He wanted to be captured, and he thought that he could be taken straight to see my father just by saying that he wished to see him.
Hess was discovered by a Scottish family, shown here on their farm where the plane crashed. Hess claimed to have a very important message for the Duke of Hamilton, but at first they refused to believe that the man who had parachuted into their field was the Deputy Führer of the Third Reich.
My father was told that a German pilot had landed and was asking to see the Duke of Hamilton. My father went and saw the prisoner, who introduced himself as Hess. It was quite amusing because my father went to see Churchill. and was taken in to see the great man who was about to relax and watch a Marx Brothers film that evening. Churchill was quite incredulous about this. I think his words were, "Do you mean to tell me that the deputy Führer is in our hands?" And when my father said, "I think it could be the case," he said, "Well, Hess or no Hess, I'm still going to watch the Marx Brothers film."
Churchill's strange reaction to Hess's flight remains unexplained. A great deal of information about the events of May 1941 remain classified in British war files. The Führer's reaction remains equally puzzling.
Well, Hitler's reaction to Hess's flight was one of his major acting performances. He made a tremendous performance of surprise, shock, horror, and everything else. When it appeared that Hess's mission had failed, of course, then all the propaganda came out that Hess was a lone madman. He did it on his own, and he was a bit, you know, a few cups short of a tea set.
Hitler blamed the entire Hess affair on the advice of Hess's astrologers. In response, the Nazi propaganda ministry issued an edict called Action Hess that forbade the public practice of any occult sciences, including astrology.
The result was a further clampdown on the activities of astrologers, who were eventually all rounded up in the Aktion Hess a month after Hess's flight. They arrested all the prominent astrologers that they knew about and took them away for interrogation.
Karl Kraft, the man who provided Goebbels with the powerful reinterpretations of Nostradamus, as well as strikingly accurate astrological predictions, would suffer the ultimate punishment, according to a former colleague. Eduard Kalik was a political prisoner who became friends with Kraft during their time in a concentration camp together.
He said, "Eduard, you will survive, but they will kill me because I know too many secrets." He went to Buchenwald and he said, "They will kill me there." And he was killed there.
The astrologers who were arrested under the Action Hess were treated in different ways depending on their use to the Reich. Those already working for Himmler were released immediately and allowed to continue their work. During this time, Himmler came into contact with one of Germany's leading astrologers, Wilhelm Wolff.
He was arrested along with all the other astrologers. Wolff himself says that he used to tell his guards about their horoscopes. Wolff then started casting horoscopes for General Schellenberg, who was head of counterintelligence under Himmler.
Walter Schellenberg was the chief of the political secret service, which was part of the SS. He was my chief and my friend. Schellenberg did not believe in astrology, but he made use of it. When Schellenberg wanted to discuss some matter with Himmler, he would explain that an astrologer had predicted this matter.
In
1943, Wolff predicted that Hitler would survive a great danger on the 20th of July, 1944, that he would fall ill in November of 1944 and die a mysterious death before the 7th of May, 1945. On the basis of these predictions, Wolff became Himmler's personal astrologer and one of his most trusted aides. All of these predictions came to pass. In a post-war interrogation by the Allies, Schellenberg admitted using Wolff to advance his own position. He believed that Wolff's influence would carry great weight with Himmler.
When I was still in prison with Schellenberg during the proceedings at Nuremberg, we still talked about it. And Schellenberg was very proud that through Wolff he could influence
Himmler.
According to Schellenberg's interrogation, during the final weeks of the war, Himmler became obsessed with the astrology of a coup. When the stars suggested he might successfully overthrow the Führer.
It was late April 1945 when Soviet troops already encircling Berlin, already entering the outskirts of Berlin, so the war is pretty well lost. Himmler remembered a conversation he had earlier with Wolff, in which Wolff told him that it looked as if there would be disaster for Germany until 1945.
Reading Hitler's chart, Wolff saw planetary arrangements that indicated a downfall. Wolff and Schellenberg continued to urge Himmler to overthrow Hitler and install himself as the leader of the waning Reich.
Both Schellenberg and Himmler trying to curry favor with the Allies. And intriguingly, in the last days of the war, a meeting between Himmler and a representative of the World Jewish Congress, at which Wolff, as Himmler's astrologer, was present. Himmler apparently agreed that there should be no more exterminations of Jews.
Despite Hitler's order to continue the exterminations to the end, Wolff was instrumental in convincing Himmler to temporarily stop the killing. Having taken this action, it appeared that Himmler was ready to launch his coup. But ultimately, his fear and loyalty to the Führer prevented him from seizing power. Himmler remained hopeful that some mystical force of destiny would alter the defeat that was clearly at hand.
Himmler was also very interested in historical parallels between the situation in the mid-40s and previous historical periods. Himmler looked back to the previous great German war with Russia, the Seven Years' War, the fought between Frederick the Great of Prussia and the Russians. Fortunes are said to have turned then when the Russian Tsarina Elizabeth died. In April 1945, President Roosevelt died, and Himmler took this as a sign that history was about to repeat itself and Germany was going to be saved.
Two weeks later, Goebbels and his entire family descended with Adolf Hitler into the Führer's private bunker. On April the 30th, Adolf Hitler and his bride, Eva Braun, committed suicide. Goebbels poisoned his six children, then shot his wife and himself. Dressed as a common German soldier, Heinrich Himmler almost managed to escape. He was arrested by the British, but during a physical examination, crushed a cyanide capsule he kept in his mouth. At 11:04 p.m. on the 23rd of May, the Reichsführer, who had summoned occult forces in the service of Aryan glory, was dead. In November 1945, several top Nazis were brought to trial by the Allies at Nuremberg. Rudolf Hess was sentenced to life in prison. He died there at the age of 93. Occultist Alfred Rosenberg was found guilty of crimes against humanity and hanged in October 1946. The Third Reich, which was to have lasted over 1,000 years, ended after only 12. Nearly 50 million had died. Ironically, among them were the first generation of Hitler's so-called master race, who were to father further generations of Aryan supermen. Throughout history, mythology has had a powerful influence on the human mind. All cultures have been mythically driven. However, in Nazi Germany, the linking of political aims to a corrupted mythology led to an evil unparalleled in history.